Good morning, folks. This is Will Aitchison. We've got a special podcast interview today with Peter Burke. Peter is a lawyer in a New Jersey law firm that specializes in, among other things, representing management interests in labor relations and employment issues. He's got a pretty stellar background. He's been involved in an awful lot of claims, both in federal court and in local state courts. Recently, and the reason for this phone call is Peter was the lead lawyer for the township of Teaneck, New Jersey, in what I think of as a very significant case coming out of the Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals involving the Fair Labor Standards Act and, in particular, the Section 7K exemption under the FLSA and a donning and doffing issue. So with that, good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning, Will.
Let's start just a little bit, if we can, with what it was the plaintiffs in the case, and they were police officers, what it was they thought they should be paid for, what time it was they were working, that they weren't being compensated for.
Sure. There were 88 plaintiffs. It wasn't brought as a collective action, so they each had their individual claims, and what they believe they should be compensated for. They had an interesting overtime provision within the collective negotiations agreement. Since they're public employers in New Jersey, we call it a collective negotiations agreement rather than a CBA. And what they thought they should be compensated for was overtime on a per tour basis of after 8 hours, they should get overtime. And they should get overtime for, they had two principal claims, that they should get overtime for what was called muster time, which is the 10 minutes before a tour of duty and the 10 minutes after, and for their time spent donning and doffing. And the donning and doffing claims here is a little different than you're used to reading about, because they, not only did the uniformed officers have a donning and doffing claim, but the plainclothes officers had a donning and doffing claim as well. So those were the two key pieces of time that they believe they were not being compensated for and that they were entitled to overtime for.
Well, right off the bat, Peter, I've got to say I'm missing something when I hear the description of those claims, because there's nothing in the FLSA, is there, that has what I would think of as a daily overtime threshold? You work more than 8 hours a day and you get paid overtime?
Correct. There is... You're not missing anything, and I, having litigated the case for a number of years, well, I'm still waiting for an answer from plaintiffs on that point. But
now, if these are general employees and not police officers, we'll get to the police officer thing in a minute. If these are, for example, non-sworn employees in the police department, what would the FLSA say their overtime threshold is? When would the law mandate they get time and a half?
The law would mandate that they get the typical four, or the well-known 40 hours a week, or overtime threshold, because overtime for a non-law enforcement officer or a firefighting personnel would get overtime under the 40-hour work week threshold, typically seen as a Monday to Friday schedule, something like that. But then there's obviously...
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. No.
Because these are police officers, though, they're covered by what I referred to earlier as the Section 7K exemption, or potentially covered by that. Can you tell us a little bit about the background of the 7K exemption and how that would apply to police officers?
Sure. The Section 7K exemption has a somewhat interesting legislative and court history. It was actually passed back in 1974, but then the Supreme Court held that it was unconstitutional in 76. So it was kind of in it was unconstitutional for a number of years, and then the Supreme Court reversed itself in 1985 in an opinion called Garcia versus San Antonio. And then in response to that, Congress became concerned about the FLSA's impact upon state and local employers, and they passed some additional amendments to the FLSA. Most importantly, regarding the 207K threshold, they gave the Secretary of Labor the authority to issue regulations setting a heightened overtime threshold for law enforcement and for firefighting personnel. And what we see now, or the outgrowth of those regulations that were passed, I believe, in 87, is this overtime threshold for work periods, not work weeks anymore. It's a work period that can range from anywhere to 7 to 28 days. It has to be a minimum of 7 days and no longer than 28 days. And for law enforcement personnel, working a 7-day schedule, it can be 5 days on, 2 days off, which we had here for some certain officers. The overtime threshold is 43 hours, and it can range all the way up to officers working a 28-day schedule, and they get paid overtime after 171 hours. And the reason why, or Congress explained these heightened overtime thresholds for law enforcement and fire protection personnel, is that there are built-in emergencies that would necessitate overtime, and then there are also non-emergency times that hopefully balance out. So by extending the work period beyond a typical work week, the thought was that the emergencies and the need for overtime would get canceled out eventually by calm periods.
And, so on the firefighter side, the work week is roughly, on the 7K exemption, roughly a 53-hour work week.
Right. It's even higher for firefighting. It goes all the way up to 212 hours for the full 28-day schedule. And
okay.
So I guess...
And if I understand this right, what the Department of Labor was doing in this study sometime between 1985 and 1987 was going out there and trying to figure out the average hours worked by police and fire in the country, and then setting the 7K thresholds based on that.
Right.
Is that right?
That sounds right. They certainly did some work to try and figure out what was being worked at the time. Obviously, they came to a conclusion that fire has greater, more emergencies than I guess law enforcement does. And they lowered the threshold from what even 207K has. The statute itself, I believe, is slightly lower, like 212 for both. It doesn't distinguish between fire and law enforcement. So it's so the Department of Labor did some sort of studies and came to the conclusion about these thresholds that they set forth.
And for our listeners' sake, the Department of Labor hasn't updated those thresholds since 1987.
Correct.
And there is currently pending before the Department of Labor a request from one national labor organization. It's known as the National Association of Police Organizations, NAPO, for the Department of Labor to redo the study. And the notion, I think, behind that request is things have changed in the last 25 years, and the average number of hours worked by police and fire are lower than they were before. But the Department of Labor hasn't taken any action on that. So we've got the 7K exemption sitting out there, and I can't remember right now, Peter, if it's the statute or the regulations, but one of them says that the employer must establish a 7K exemption. How did that come into play in your litigation involving TNAC?
Yeah, that's the regulation 553.224 that defines a work period. It has to be an established and regularly reoccurring work period. And doesn't have to be connected to a duty cycle, pay schedule. They just have to work between 7 and 28-day schedule. And in our case, we had the bargaining agreement for more than 30 years set forth the two schedules of patrol officers working a 9-day schedule, six days on, 3 days off, and all other officers for the department worked a 5-2 schedule. So that was, and then all, there was no dispute of that, and the plaintiffs even stipulated to that, and that was more than enough to establish that there was a schedule that was set out in the contract and that they actually worked the schedules that are set forth in the contract. And those two schedules had been worked for more than 30 years. So there was no dispute, but no consider. The plaintiffs never disputed it, and the Third Circuit agreed that that more than established the applicable work period thresholds.
Well, and I think this is a very important part about the Third Circuit's decision here. Sometimes employers and employees think that that word establish in the context of the 7K exemption means the employer has to do something more than just have a work schedule, has to pass an ordinance or a resolution.
Right, some sort of public declaration of intent But
And what the Third Circuit say about that?
they stuck to the plain language and said nothing is required because obviously in this case there was no public declaration and it was pursuant to the contracts. The overtime threshold was the eight and a half hour that I discussed earlier. So they're clearly, you know, the employer could believe that it was paying overtime, and I don't think there would be any dispute of that. Significantly more generously than required by the FLSA, and so because it was paying overtime more generously than required, that was not going to act as some sort of waiver that the well-established provision that employees can't waive FLSA provisions, and neither can the employer waive them by being more generous under the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. And that's what the Third Circuit latched onto.
So as I understand it, what the Third Circuit is saying, look, the employer here has a schedule, a combination of work days followed by days off, has a schedule that basically flops over every 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that means, by definition, without doing more, because that schedule flops over somewhere between 7 and 28 days in length, that means the employer can take advantage of the 7K exemption.
Correct.
Am I overstating it?
You're not overstating it. It's a relatively, I think even the First Circuit called it a relatively low hurdle to establish that as long as you have a reoccurring schedule that's actually worked by the employee, by the police officers, or I guess even law enforcement, firefighting personnel, that's enough. And here we had that schedule that's been worked for almost 30 years. So that was enough for the Third Circuit.
Now, that's not the end of your case, of course, because the police officers are saying, look, we've done all this uncompensated work. We've done this muster time, and we've done donning and doffing, and, you know, that may take us above the 7K thresholds. So the Third Circuit ends up focusing on whether the muster time and the donning and doffing, whether or not that was uncompensated work. And how did it tackle the muster? First of all, not everybody, the phrase muster time isn't used all over the country. What is it, and how did the Third Circuit deal with this?
Muster time, you often see on police shows, is when the officers come in the morning or on a shift change, and there's the sergeant, you know, announces particular patrol areas of emphasis or gives the updates as to, you know, what's going on and what to look out for. It's generally like an information sharing. And or it's sometimes called roll call as well. So that's a 10-minute information sharing that at the beginning of the tour. And then at the end of the tour, there's another 10 minutes where there's a general what happened on the tour, you know, what did you see, what do we need to emphasize, what looks like a problem, things like that. Are again addressed by the sergeant, and then he also collects any reports that were done, any other paperwork, tickets, things like that. And that's what muster time or roll call time is considered.
And what did the Third Circuit say as to whether or not that was unpaid time that was owing more compensation?
They found it to be part of the officer's salaries, that it was not unpaid overtime, that it was, they looked at the language in the agreement, of the particular bargaining agreement at issue, and said that time was a component of their salary, and would be it wouldn't make sense to think that after 30 years working with these provisions, that the officers and their union, these officers were represented by a PBA union and a Superior Officers Association union as well, would continue to agree to a contract that would not pay them for 20 minutes a day. And the Third Circuit also noted that the plaintiffs had no evidence that this, even if they did work this muster time, which not all officers, and the officers in this case, not all officers worked. Muster time is primarily worked for by patrol officers. Officers, we had officers like in the Detective Bureau and the Services Bureau, things like dealing with records and, you know, evidence work did not even work this muster time that they claimed. It was just a vestige of contract that just applied, originally grew out of just patrol officers. So the Third Circuit basically said there's no language in here in the bargaining agreement that would say that this muster time was not part of their salary. It wouldn't make sense for it not to be. And even if they were not compensated for it, there's no evidence by plaintiffs that this muster time worked ever put them over the FLSA threshold that was established under 207K.
And I know our listeners are going to be probably turning to their collective bargaining agreements and wondering how the language matches up with the TNEC language. What did the TNEC contract specifically say about muster time?
It had some interesting language. There were two pieces that the Third Circuit placed particular emphasis upon. That for purposes of that the officers will be required to work an average of 39 and a quarter hours per week over a calendar year cycle. So they found that language indicated that, you know, their hours per week are going to go up and down. There are going to be some hours that they work more, sometimes that they work less. And that there's also, and then the important language regarding muster time was that it required them to be ready for a tour of duty. Employees will report for duty 10 minutes prior to the start of the tour and will be dismissed from duty 10 minutes after the end of their tour. And then you add that language to a normal tour of duty shall be an 8-hour time division of the day. And this is the important language for the Third Circuit, for the purposes of assignment. It doesn't say for purposes of payroll, which plaintiffs would have liked. It said for the purposes of assignment, they'll work an 8-hour day, and then they'll have that 20 minutes of muster time. So because there's no language in the agreement that says that they're only getting paid for an 8-hour day, the Third Circuit concluded that it was reasonable to believe that their salary included time that they were scheduled to work, or the 8-hour and 20-minute day.
And Kevin, you've used a word that I think is an important one. You've used it several times, and that's the word salary. If you turn to the wage schedule in the TNEC contract, do we find an hourly rate or a monthly wage or an annual wage? What do we find?
You'll find an annual salary, I believe.
So what the Third Circuit then, it seems to me, is saying is, look, you recognize the existence of muster time in the context of your collective bargaining agreement. You included a clause that specifically says you have to show up and do it. You've got an annual salary sitting here on the other end of the collective bargaining agreement. In essence, you've negotiated that muster time is paid for already by your salary.
Right.
Do I have that right?
You have that right.
Okay. Now let's turn to donning and doffing. And I want to set the stage just a moment before I ask you about how the TNEC issue looked at donning and doffing. And just for our listeners, donning and doffing in the Supreme Court, this is an issue that goes back almost 60 years at this point in time. The court has held that the activity of donning and doffing protective gear and clothing, both of those are compensable under the FLSA. We start with a long ago case called Steiner, where the employees were working in a battery factory, all sorts of exposure to acids and the like, and they were donning and doffing old work clothes. And the Supreme Court found that that was work. That was related enough to the employee's job that that was work that needed to be compensated. Donning and doffing largely stayed a matter in the private sector, coming right all the way through the 1990s. The Supreme Court looked at the matter again with a couple of cases involving meat and poultry processing companies, and assumed without really deciding that donning and doffing was compensable work under the FLSA. Nobody argued that it wasn't compensable work, and so it was really a set decision by them. Well, floating along with the notion that donning and doffing is compensable, floating along is this odd little section of the FLSA known as Section 2030. And what Section 2030 says, and I'm going to ask Peter to tear it apart in a moment, but what Section 2030 says is, look, if you've got a collective bargaining agreement, if you've got a union on the scene, and if the union, by agreement or pattern and practice, has assented to the notion that donning and doffing of clothing, and I'm using that word specifically, is non-compensable, then the whole activity is non-compensable. So in other words, if there's a union on the scene, we're going to leave the issue of compensation for donning and doffing to the negotiations process. That's what Congress has said, if the donning and doffing is clothing. And then last year, the Supreme Court weighs in again. The Supreme Court has a very unusual interest in this issue of donning and doffing. Disproportionate number of Supreme Court FLSA cases involve donning and doffing. The Supreme Court looks at donning and doffing in a steel mill, and the question the court has to decide is this Section 2030 issue. What's clothing and what's not? Because if you think about it, people going into a steel mill who are donning and doffing stuff are donning and doffing some things that are more equipment-like, more protective in safety, and they're donning and doffing some things that are more clothing-like, pants, for example, and shirts. And the Supreme Court had to decide, well, what do we do with this situation? What does the word clothing mean in the context of Section 2030? And then what do we do if somebody's donning and doffing a mix of things? And Peter, now I'll turn to you. And when we look at this U.S. Steel case, and we'll post the decision on our webpage so people can go read it. When the Supreme Court is talking about this 2030 issue in the U.S. Steel case, how does it answer those two questions? What's clothes and what are not clothes? And what happens when an employee is donning and doffing a mix of those things?
Sure. In the U.S. Steel case, or the Sandifer case, the Supreme Court, with I believe the opinion was by Scalia, took a very pragmatic approach to the issue. And you really get the fundamental takeaway is that the courts don't want to deal with this issue and would prefer that employers and their unions deal with it through the collective bargaining process. There's language in here about federal judges should not be time management professionals and should not be parsing out this issue. So what the court sets out is that the first important piece is for 2030, this whole notion of changing clothes. It notes, albeit in a footnote, but it notes that this is not an exemption, but a definition. So by saying it's a definition, it could be expanded and interpreted very broadly, whereas we well know that the FLSA exemptions are to be interpreted very narrowly. In the U.S. Steel case, they really gave a very broad definition, but they said fundamentally that changing clothes is basically articles of dress and what you would typically use to cover the body. And that would include things like, as the Third Circuit decided in Rosano, you know, pants, shirt, hat, things like that. It leaves out things like equipment, which would be, in theory, like with the police here, a flashlight, a firearm, the other paraphernalia that a police officer may be carrying. But once again, going back to the pragmatic approach, that if you spend the vast majority of the time donning and doffing clothes, i.e. putting on articles of dress, then the whole thing is going to be considered changing clothes, even if there is some time spent putting on equipment and tending to that sort of thing. Justice Scalia actually had a very interesting metaphor about saying that you're going skiing. This is in U.S. Sandifer, where you can go skiing, but you might spend a not insignificant amount of time drinking hot toddies and having lunch. Even though you're drinking hot toddies and having lunch, your fundamental activity is skiing. And with that analogy, it applies here that if the bulk of what you're doing or what an employee is doing is putting clothes on, even though there is some piece, some equipment involved, then it will be non-compensable under 2030.
And so how did the court in Teaneck, in your case, how did the court apply that to the officers donning and doffing?
They applied it. They went through every item in a uniformed for a uniformed officer, and they went through, and they clearly identified that the articles of dress, fairly straight, you know, things like uniform, jacket, shirt, pants, dress, shoes, gloves, things like that, are clearly clothes. They spend the time doing those, and if there was some equipment involved, such as, you know, the nightstick, ID, firearm, ammunition, whistles, things like that. But the fact that you clearly, the bulk of the activity and the bulk of the time is clearly spent putting on the uniform and changing clothes, and that the, whatever time may be spent addressing these equipment type issues, like putting in the nightstick into the into the belt and putting on the badge and things like that, does not change the fundamental character of the activities from putting on changing clothes to changing putting on equipment. And so because the bulk of the time is spent changing clothes, then it was non-compensable under 2030. It's time spent donning and doffing clothes. And there was no dispute that there was a pattern in practice, as well as the collective bargaining agreements were silent on the issue of compensation. So that's the first piece that always has to be addressed, is that there's a long-standing pattern of practice, or the collective bargaining agreement specifically addresses the issue of not compensating for changing clothes. So
well,
then
let me ask you a question then, Peter. First of all, I'll confess a little bit of my background here. I've handled, from the plaintiff side, representing police officers, I've handled several donning and doffing cases. There was a case out of the city of Mesa that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decided, where the court held donning and doffing wasn't a compensable activity if the employer let officers have the option of donning and doffing at home. I also handled a case decided after that Mesa case involving Denver, where the court reached the opposite decision and said, hey, if the activity donning and doffing is work, it has to be compensable. And the fact that the employer lets the employee do it at home, that doesn't make it any less work. So, I mean, I've handled cases that have come out both ways on the issue. You can probably guess which one I think is the right decision. But I will say that whenever I've handled a donning and doffing case, the way I have approached it from the standpoint of being a plaintiff's lawyer is I would have employees time themselves donning and doffing and time how much it took to how much time it took to don and doff each piece of equipment or clothes. I anticipated this 2030 issue would be raised by an employer. And so, you know, how long does it take to put on a firearm, do the functions check of a firearm that you might do, that sort of thing. Was that sort of time study done by the plaintiffs in your case?
Yes, to a point. Each plaintiff provided an estimate of the time spent putting on, donning and doffing their uniform, and gave an amount of time that varied. You know, we also had the plainclothes officers doing the same thing, but the uniformed officers did that analysis where they gave an estimate of how long it took to do pretty much everything from underwear up in terms of what they put on and off. The piece that they did not supply was how those time estimates then put them over an FLSA threshold under, as we talked about before, the 207K threshold. They didn't supply that estimate. They never transferred the time they supposedly spent putting on and off their uniform against, and whether or not that time got them over an overtime threshold.
I see. And when you would look at your average officer in TNAC, would they be spending more time donning and doffing equipment or more time donning and doffing uniforms?
More time donning and doffing uniforms. And then I would also note that the time spent doing those activities varied significantly from officer to officer. But there was more time spent putting on a uniform.
Oh, you know, been there, done that. I've represented over 1,000 officers on these sorts of claims, and I can tell you the range probably, I'm guessing, went from 3 minutes to an hour or something like that, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the other interesting point, just to get back to one earlier point, you talked about the city of Mesa case. The district court in the TNAC case did consider that argument. We relied upon the Bamonte v. City of Mesa case that said the issue was that the time was preliminary, post-preliminary, non-compensable time because there was no rule requiring them to don and doff on premises. The Third Circuit just did not feel a need to address that issue at that time. But I'll just, you know, show my management side leanings and think that the city of Mesa also provides an excellent rationale for why this time should not be compensable. But since, in the least in the law enforcement context in New Jersey, and I imagine most places, that it's a unionized workforce. So that's why 2030 is probably will be addressed more frequently.
Just as a on a personal note, Peter, for whatever reason, somebody was videotaping my oral arguments before the Ninth Circuit in the City of Mesa case. And if you ever want to see a lawyer getting savaged in an oral argument, I mean, if that's something you do recreationally, go to YouTube and put in my name along with City of Mesa, and it'll be a very enjoyable experience. I will note, by the way, that Mesa was a 2-1 decision. One of the three judges on that panel did get it right. That's quite another issue. So what we're going to have then, if I'm looking into the future, from the TNEC case, and I'm thinking about these Donning and Doffing cases, what I'm thinking is that police officers who are bringing these claims are going to be very careful about counting up how much time they spend on every single issue or every single item that they are donning and doffing and putting it into one of these two buckets, the equipment bucket or the clothing bucket. Is that a decent prediction?
I think so, but they will also have an exceedingly difficult time because the Third Circuit was quite specific in identifying what's changing clothes. And so there's not a significant, I don't believe there's a significant variation with the typical police officer's uniform compared to what the Third Circuit discussed in Rosano. So I think it'll be very difficult for them to suddenly say that the time they spend, you know, addressing, you know, polishing their handcuffs, putting their handcuffs in the belt there and the nightstick and things like that will suddenly exceed the time they spend donning and doffing their uniform based upon the Rosano case.
Oh, Peter, you're not nearly as optimistic as I am about that. I'm curious. I would like a prediction from you. Let's say the next case that comes down on donning and doffing, and let's put it out of the Third Circuit. Let's put it, you know, someplace that's never considered the issue. And I don't think, for example, let's take a circuit that's very changing in terms of the political orientation of the judges on it. Let's take the Fourth Circuit down there in Virginia, that neck of the country. Let's say the Fourth Circuit gets a donning and doffing case, and let's assume there's a collective bargaining agreement, so Section 2030 applies. And let's say the testimony from the officers is, look, I spend 15 minutes a day donning and doffing. And I have done time studies on this, and of the 15 minutes that I spend, 10 minutes is spent on donning and doffing equipment, and 5 minutes is on clothing. What would U.S. Steel tell us, or your Third Circuit case, that you've said it, referred to it as Rosano, that's the same thing as the TNEC case. What would the U.S. Steel case and the TNEC Rosano case tell us about whether those officers would have a claim?
Well, I think the U.S. Steel case is, they would probably find a way. I mean, I'm speaking for my hypothetical defense firm that's out there defending against your hypothetical plaintiff's firm, that I still think it would be exceedingly difficult for them to really prove their equipment claim is taking changes to characterization of what they do, because they want to look at U.S. Steel gives the example of somebody, for example, puts I think it was a scuba diver, that most of the time there is clearly spent getting equipment ready, and there's relatively less time putting on, I guess a wetsuit or whatever was in Justice Scalia's example. And I think with putting on a police uniform, I think the fundamental activity is still in terms of becoming or doing the job as a police officer would be putting on the uniform, and that's the fundamental characterization of the activity, and that putting on equipment is still secondary to putting on that uniform. So I still think under Sandifer, that I think that the plaintiffs would still have a difficult time, even in a case where they're somehow or another able to have the undisputed assertion that somehow the majority of their time is spent on equipment as opposed to actually putting on their uniform.
Okay, understood. Well, hey, Peter, first of all, congratulations on the victory for your client. And secondly, thanks for participating in this interview. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, appreciate being on and you taking the time with me.
Okay. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Will.
Bye.
Bye.